So in the case of Al-Bayt, it's quite different. Even Imam Jawad alayhi salam, he became an imam while he was in an early age.
In a very early age. Well, Dr. Alavi, thank you so much for being with us. You provided us information like how the waiters can help the imam. And in the words of Imam itself, Imam Bakr al-Islam and Imam Sadiq al-Islam, you shed light upon many narrations and you clearly mentioned how we can help, which is indeed a help to ourselves as well. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio.
Extremist Israeli settlers.
Precise technical solutions to make Israelis, Palestinians, and the region safer and much more prosperous.
This deal is not a deal for peace or a peace plan. It is a war plan because this legalized the occupation. This plan legalized the settlements. This plan legalized the annexation of Jerusalem. This plan says no return for the Palestinian refugees.
You know, we are the oppressed and they are the oppressors. And they want the oppressed to give more to the oppressor. They want the oppressed to be oppressed more.
What would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
The deal of the century. The Trump so-called peace plan, which the Israelis and the United States of America claim will bring peace to the Middle East, but the Palestinians outright reject and say is an attack on their national identity as well as their land. I'm Robert Inlakesh, and I've come here to occupied Palestine to investigate what the so-called deal of the century means for the Palestinian people and the future of Palestine. Following the official release of the controversial plan proposed to end the Palestine-Israel conflict, an escalation of violence ensued in occupied Palestine as Israeli occupation forces brutally attacked Palestinian demonstrators, only to strengthen the resolve of the Palestinian national resistance. Being on the ground in Palestine, I lived through this round of violence, witnessing vivid scenes of brutality, racist hate crimes, and the murder of Palestinians. But before we investigate this further, we have to first look at the past to understand how things got to where they are today. The peace process between Palestinians and Israelis, as it is often referred to, was officially initiated with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993. When PLO leader Yasser Arafat signed the agreement with the Israelis, it was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state and the ending of hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis. However, a Palestinian state, as well as peace in the Middle East, never came. Instead, the Oslo Accords had meant for the newly established Palestinian Authority that they had accepted an exclusively Jewish ethno-state on 78% of their historic homeland and received nothing in return. 5 years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was even more deeply entrenched as Israeli settlements expanded on Palestinian land. The only difference on the ground, as peace talks had been ongoing, was that there had been further theft of Palestinian West Bank resources, the besiegement of Gaza, and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. All of this whilst the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah, had acted to protect Israeli security interests. Then, following the second Palestinian uprising in 2000, the illegal separation wall was later built in 2002 in the West Bank, usurping approximately 10% of the territory, also collectively punishing 150 Palestinian communities who were disconnected from their lands, according to the human rights group B'Tselem. Settlements continued expanding and the further confiscation of land and resources from Palestinians ensued, with illegal religious extremist Israeli settlers seizing Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem as well as in the West Bank, all of this being justified by the Israeli claim that Palestinian terrorists had to be subdued and Israel's security had to be protected. Now, Donald Trump's self-proclaimed roadmap to peace would essentially allow for Israel to take half of the West Bank, annexing the most fertile agricultural lands, aquifers, and prohibiting Palestinians from having an army or any real autonomy. It would also connect Palestinian Bantustans together via underground tunnels. Upon arriving in occupied Palestine, I had traveled to the village of Kafin near Tulkarm, where an unarmed 19-year-old boy named Badr was shot in the neck and killed by Israeli occupation forces for protesting against the deal of the century. Unfortunately, this was not the last funeral that I attended of young people and children who had been murdered in the West Bank. However, they all resembled each other roughly. Palestinian family members grieving, the look of disbelief on a broken mother's face, and the cries from the village for a day where the martyrdom of their brother or sister will enable a free Jerusalem al-Quds, a belief that gives meaning to the life of those martyred. Al-Quds is at the heart of every Palestinian. It is holy to both Muslim and Christian Palestinians who are currently unable to visit if they live in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, or Palestinian diaspora. The international consensus for a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict states that East Jerusalem is to be the capital of the future Palestinian state. This, however, is not what is being allocated to the Palestinians under the Trump-Netanyahu vision. Instead, they are confining the capital of the Palestinian people to outside the separation walls of Jerusalem al-Quds.
I'm standing here in Abu Dis, the proposed capital for the Palestinian people. And of course, Abu Dis here is a suburb just outside of mainland Jerusalem al-Quds. And what we see here in Abu Dis is the apartheid system in the West Bank at its most clearest. We see over here behind us Palestinian villages, Jerusalemites, separated from their brethren and their lands on the other side of the wall over here. People who have been separated so that they cannot see their family members, that they cannot come and farm their lands, and of course separated by this wall. If this was to be accepted as the capital of Palestine, that would mean not only would it be this little slither of land, which would not include the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, but it means that it will be a symbol of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And for them to live like this, seeing every single day what could have been, and Jerusalem al-Quds with Masjid al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rocks in the background, is utter pain and struggle.
This separation of Jerusalemite Muslims and Christians from Jerusalem al-Quds is rarely ever shown on mainstream Western television. And so, before you travel to the West Bank, one would imagine that the situation is completely different from the reality faced here. What my cameraman and I witnessed on the Palestinian side of Israel's wall was the humiliation of Palestinians on a daily basis, and a space allocated for a capital which would hardly drive tourism to a country with its depressing scenery, bringing with it a feeling of walking around in an open-air prison. Even on the other side of the wall, Palestinian homes are constantly being demolished and stolen by Israeli settlers, as Donald Trump emboldens their actions with the decree that Israel's undivided capital is to be Jerusalem al-Quds. The justification given by Israel for such disturbing realities imposed on the ground is that what has been imposed is for Israel's security. But even if that was the truth behind the occupation and violations of international law, this excuse was not accepted internationally by the court of public opinion when it came to apartheid South African whites. So why is it reasonable coming from Israeli Jews, I ask? But the issue of division isn't the only problem facing the Palestinians. There is also the problem of where the two divided peoples would live if remaining segregated, and where any viable borders could possibly exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. The issues of borders is of course made tough due to the Israeli illegal racial colonies, or settlements as they're referred to.
Something that you cannot escape when you come here to the West Bank is seeing and witnessing how deeply entrenched these settlements are into the Palestinian land here.
Currently, over 750,000 illegal Israeli settlers live on stolen Palestinian land, equating to a land grab of 40% of the West Bank. Due to seizure of land, Palestinians currently live in 165 disconnected islands surrounded by checkpoints, military outposts, closed military zones, and settlements. What is perhaps more disturbing, however, is the fact that one of the chief architects of what is supposed to be a peace deal, Jared Kushner, has direct ties to the funding of an illegal settlement named Beit El, with almost 100,000 US dollars that we know about. Kushner is also an open supporter of illegal settlements. Understanding that under Trump's so-called peace plan, settlements will remain in place, I traveled to occupied Al-Khalil, or Hebron as it's called, to meet with local human rights activist Issa Amro to learn more about what the situation would remain as in the heart of the illegal settler conflict zone.
Trump's plan is to make this permanent. Trump's plan is about, you know, legitimizing the settlements and legitimizing this apartheid and segregation and separation and keep me without any basic human rights.
They don't want us to film their weakness and their truth. They don't want us to expose that Israel is an apartheid state, Israel is not a democracy, and Israel is not a state of law. It's the state of settlers, soldiers, and it's the state of apartheid and segregation. So the street is closed, all the shops are closed by military orders, and marked as closed shops. Look, it's marked, sealed, welded as closed shop. It was closed first 1994 after the Ibrahim Mosque massacre.
And what justification do they give? Why do they say they have to be closed? Do they give you a justification for closing it?
Always, always. The false justification is security. The main reason for it, it's about confiscation and to have the Arab free zone here. Closing the city center. It's the hub of the city, you know. It's the heart of the city. They closed it and they control it and they drive here. We are not allowed to drive. We are not allowed to drive in our own streets. Our shops are closed. Our houses became empty. They changed the names of the streets from Palestinian Arabic name to Israeli Hebrew names. The road signs are only in English and Hebrew. Israeli flags here, they are taking our identity as Palestinian identity.
And this system right here with the shops closed and everything happening, under Trump's plan, this would remain closed?
It will remain closed. They didn't touch it. They didn't talk about it.
The main entrance to the family
is closed. The main road is closed. And we are using the fields to reach the house here. And the family is separated and isolated alone. And the army is occupying the roof. They have a military post on the roof. The family is not allowed to go to the roof.
Yeah.
And they are locked inside the house. And from time to time, the settlers come to the roof, throw stones, throw rocks, throw rubbish to the family without any help. Not only that, Palestinian ambulance is not allowed to reach here
without a special coordination. So you skip all the emergency cases. So you are not only sieged by the army and the soldiers, you are sieged from any kind of basic human rights.
We continued until we reached a military outpost where we were at first instructed at gunpoint to go back because Palestinians could not walk on the Jewish-only street there. So we filmed secretly as I asked the soldier present why Aisa and my cameraman Hamdi were not able to walk on the road. The soldier I just engaged with refused to speak to me until I told him I was not a Palestinian. But many other soldiers had an even more negative attitude towards us, making it clear that Palestinians or any friends of Palestinians were not welcome. After witnessing the situation in Al Khalil, I then traveled to Ramallah in order to take part in protests rejecting the deal of the century. At this protest you're seeing alone, tens of protesters were shot and many others gassed, causing them to collapse and convulse.
We have an attack here on a member of the press, clearly marked as press. Is of course a violation of international law, firing tear gas everywhere. He passed out unconscious. This man is marked as a press, and of course is not protesting. He's here to document purely, and he was targeted by the Israelis.
After the demonstration, we found out following a visit to the Ramallah hospital that four young boys were shot with internationally banned bullets. Three were hit in the legs and one in the head. The protests I witnessed, however, were just the tip of the iceberg. Other demonstrations were much more violent and led to the deaths of several young Palestinians. To find out more about why Palestinian people broke out into mass protest against the deal of the century, I met with the world-renowned journalist Jana Jihad and Palestinian icon Ahed Tamimi, both locals to the village of Nabi Saleh.
So since the announcement of the so-called
first asking Jana what she had witnessed since the announcement of the Trump plan.
As you said, are getting killed, people are getting arrested. I'm facing checkpoints on my way to school every day. Like for example, yesterday I was just going to my school and then there was this checkpoint. You know, the checkpoints here in the West Bank are not checkpoints. They're just a gate on the street. They usually close it, block the street, and then they go. They don't check the car, they just block it. So, like, I had to take another way that takes me about triple the time to get to my school. I was late to my school. Even today, we were stuck for 2 hours on the checkpoint. Every day since the deal of the century had been declared, you know, people, there are a lot of clashes, people are getting killed, people are getting injured, and it's very sad that we are paying the price of something that we didn't cause.
What we heard from Donald Trump was that when this deal was initially announced, that there would be some sort of peace that would come out of this, and that the Palestinians would receive a great amount of money.
I believe that legalizing what's illegal is not peace. Legalizing occupation, legalizing settlements, it's not what we call peace. And I don't care about money. I just want my land. I want to stay in my house. I want to go to the sea that I've never been to, which is only 30 minutes far from my house, that I can literally see every single morning from the roof of my house that I've never been to. That's what I call peace, but that's not peace. And I don't care about money. What if I came and told you I want half of America, I'd pay you, but I just want half of America. Like, what would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
In Ramallah, I witnessed the largest demonstration the city had seen since the time of the Second Intifada, or uprising as it is known in English. What was clear to me in the West Bank was that there was a growing sense of desperation and also unity from the Palestinian people that could be felt building day by day. The desperation for action coming from the threat immediately posed to annex areas such as the Jordan Valley, which is where I began to travel to next.
So we've just entered the Jordan Valley here, and what we witnessed just as we were entering was the closed military zones here, and the soldiers in the fields actually aiming just above children and telling them to duck, using them sort of as firing practice. And then what we also discovered as we were driving along is that two Bedouin children, young children who were riding on donkeys, were also arrested by the army. The Jordan Valley is home to 70,000 Palestinians, yet is 85% inaccessible to its people, as Israel has turned the land into a military training ground and allowed for illegal settlers to come in and make goods to sell around the world. The area is under international law recognized as Palestinian land, which is to be the future agricultural hub of Palestine. Its undeveloped areas could also be used for energy projects, water extraction, and urban centers. One of the most important things to understand about the Jordan Valley is that this land here constitutes 30% of the West Bank, and of course means the loss of the most fertile agricultural land for a potential future Palestinian state. What you can see straight away when you come here to the Jordan Valley is that the people primarily here are building their houses as tents and as sort of cave structures and things like this, because the Israelis don't allow them here in Area C to actually build, have the permits to build homes. So if they were to actually build proper homes already before the land being annexed, and of course these people inevitably being expelled, then their homes would be bulldozed.
The conditions that have been imposed in the plan says that there is no Palestinian state. So what will happen with us? We are here more than 50% of the population. Now every year they demolish about 500 houses there. This plan says no Palestinian state and no sovereignty, no borders, no water, no air, no underground. Nothing for the Palestinians. In Jordan Valley, we are 70,000 Palestinians, and and the Israeli settlers are only 8,000. So we have to stay, and our existence there will be the main factor to stop the century plan.
It was clear from even before U.S. President Donald Trump, alongside Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, announced the details of the plan, that the Israeli regime sought to annex the Jordan Valley, northern Dead Sea, and illegal settlements, throwing away all the progress of work done since 1988 between Palestinians and Israelis. Looking on at the situation on the ground in Palestine, it was clear that a two-state solution looked impossible, and that a one-state solution where Palestinians could live with equal rights to Israelis was a long way from coming to fruition. However, the younger generation of Palestinians served as a great source of hope that one day liberation could perhaps be in sight, and that the failure of the old is now being replaced by a new vision for peace coming from the young.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a report, the Israeli regime used weapons made and funded by the United States to destroy projects and businesses in the Gaza Strip during its devastating 11-day war on the besieged enclave last year. We present you an article written by Daniel Bogoslov. The piece is titled, Israel Used U.S. Weapons to Destroy Assets and Aid Projects in Gaza. The article has appeared on the front page of the Intercept website. Last May, in an assault on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime deployed hundreds of bombs, missiles and shells, murdering over 240 Palestinians and wounding more than 1,900 others. Despite Zionist regime's claims that it only targets combatants from Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups, more than half of the martyred were civilians. At the end of the 11-day assault, tens of thousands of Gazans were displaced from damaged homes, already struggling in a region with a 50% unemployment rate, toxic water, and crumbling infrastructure. Thousands of housing units, hundreds of schools, and 19 healthcare facilities were damaged. Documents and reporting reviewed by The Intercept show compounding the devastating toll on Palestinian civilians. Weapons made and funded by the United States were used to destroy humanitarian projects and businesses in Gaza. The destruction reached multiple hospitals, water treatment facilities, and dozens of schools operated by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. Raad Jarar, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, told The Intercept, "The vast majority of ammunition used by Israel is manufactured or subsidized by the United States." Raad Jarar added, "It's fair to say that every Israeli munition is subsidized by the United States one way or another by U.S. tax dollars." Impoverished in no small part thanks to a decade-and-a-half-long Israeli blockade, the Gaza Strip relies heavily on foreign aid to avert the worst humanitarian outcomes. According to documents compiled from the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority and human rights groups, more than 100 UNRWA facilities in Gaza were damaged in the 11-day bombing campaign in May of 2021, requiring over $1 million in repairs. Dozens more schools administered by the Palestinian Authority suffered similar damage. In 2014, during an earlier Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, a Hellfire missile manufactured and paid for by the United States targeted an UNRWA school, murdering 10 civilians. The massacre drew widespread condemnation, even eliciting a rare rebuke from the Obama administration, whose press secretary decried it as totally indefensible. Michael Link, the recently departed United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of humanitarian rights in the Palestinian territories, said, "A major reason for the perpetuation of Israeli occupation and the deaths and suffering which accompany it is the extraordinary military, diplomatic and political support given to it, largely without conditions, by the United States." Michael Link added, "This American military assistance is provided, notwithstanding the fact that congressional laws governing U.S. weapons exports claim that recipient countries cannot be engaged in consistent patterns of gross human rights violations. While Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, it is subject to virtually no checks in operation, ensuring that U.S. weapons are not used to commit war crimes, destroy United Nations-funded projects, or damage the property of civilians in the Gaza Strip. Since 1948, the United States has provided the Israeli regime with over $150 billion worth in assistance, receiving in exchange a foothold in a region of massive strategic importance. The current model exists under a Memorandum of Understanding that President Barack Obama signed in 2016, committing to $38 billion in aid between 2019 and 2028, with an open-door policy for additional aid, like the $1 billion Congress gave the Zionist regime in March for for its Iron Dome missile defense system. The aid system also provides cash flow financing, a system resembling layaway that allows Israel to purchase weapons in the present using money from the future. And it contains an offshore procurement exemption offered to no other country that allows the Israeli regime to spend US tax dollars on its own weapons industry without disclosing how it spent the money to Congress or the American public. And of course, the United States maintains its own stockpiled weapons in the occupied Palestinian territories, available for use by the Israeli forces, despite Israel's status as one of the largest arms exporters in the world. In two instances, Israel tapped into the US stockpile to wage campaigns against the Palestinian resistance group Hamas and the Lebanese Islamic resistance movement Hezbollah. The end result is an Israeli arsenal almost entirely composed of weapons made or subsidized by the United States. As bombs fell on the Gaza Strip last May, the smell of roasting nuts and sizzling potatoes was replaced with the overwhelming stench of burnt plastic. A potato chip factory and a Matouk ice cream factory, which once produced snacks in the hope of instilling a glimmer of joy in the blockaded strip, were completely destroyed in the bombing. Many of the companies established in Gaza's industrial zone did so under the pretext that the Israeli military would not bomb the commercial site. Financed by US aid and fired on by US-funded weapons, the area was thought to be protected under the auspices of the Oslo Accords, which created a special economic zone intended to supplant conflict with mutually beneficial free trade. Also impacted were the Foamco mattress factory, the main producer of mattresses for Gaza, the Abu Iskandar plastic factory, the Clever detergent factory, the Siksik plastic pipes factory, and the Al-Wadi food plant, resulting in tens of millions of dollars worth of damage. The factories employed 1,500 Palestinians and were severely impacted by the shelling in the early morning hours on 17th and 18th of May 2021. The Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which received a $900,000 grant from UNAID to build a surgery center, was also damaged in the Israeli bombing campaign, as was Beit Hanun Hospital, another recipient of UNAID funding. While mechanisms for punishing war crimes perpetrated with US support are selectively enforced against many other countries, the lack of scrutiny over the Israeli regime's forces' use of American weaponry is glaring. Amid last May's onslaught, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace detailed a number of US laws violated by Israel's attacks on Gaza. These included the Foreign Assistance Act, which stipulates that aid cannot be provided to a country which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. Also, the Arms Export Control Act, which bans U.S. military assistance to countries using weapons for reasons other than legitimate self-defense. And the Leahy Laws, named after outgoing U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, which ban weapon sales to military units that have committed a gross violation of human rights. In May of 2021, as last year's bombing campaign drew to a close, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and several progressive members of the House of Representatives introduced resolutions to block a $735 million weapons package that included the same type of precision-guided bombs that the Israeli regime was already using to shell Gaza. Senator Bernie Sanders said at the time, "I believe that the United States must help lead the way to a peaceful and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians. We need to take a hard look at whether the sale of these weapons is actually helping do that, or whether it is simply fueling conflict. But the White House demurred. Then White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki claimed, "We have seen reports of a move towards a potential ceasefire. That is clearly encouraging." The Biden administration approved the sale. This May, Israel launched another bombing campaign on the Gaza Strip.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the jurisprudential rules and Islamic laws on, Hajj and the pilgrimage to Mecca, the House of God, and we talked about, several issues regarding Hajj, and the typology of Hajj,
sure.
As well. You know, can a person perform two Umrahs in the same month?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I should clarify the term Umrah for our audience because many people might not understand what Umrah actually is. Umrah is the recommended Hajj.
Mm-hmm.
That not the obligatory one, because we should separate or we should distinguish between the obligatory Hajj, which is called Hajjatul Islam or Hajjat Tamattu, and then of course Hajj Qiran and Hajj Ifrad. Those three types of Hajj are there, but of course Hajjatul Islam, the obligatory Hajj, begins with Umrah, and Umrah is part of the Hajjatul Islam in that case.
Yes.
And they should be done together in the same month, in the same, year, at least. And then when it comes to recommended Umrah, because Umrah in and of itself is recommended. For example, if you want to perform Umrah in the month of Rajab or Sha'ban or Ramadan, which most people do, of course.
Yes.
It remains to be recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question that you just asked, it was whether it is permissible to perform two Umrahs in the same year, because the more, for example, many people might think that, okay, the more Umrah you perform and the more sawab you will gain.
Yes.
Is that the case? Of course, it's not the case. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it is not permissible to perform two Umrahs on this in the same week, in the same month.
Or in the same year?
And No. In the same year, of course, you can do it. But if you are doing Umrah on different months, okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, for example, you want to perform one Umrah in the month of Zilhajjah and another Umrah in the month of Zilqa'dah. Ramadan and Sha'ban, okay? Shawwal.
Yes.
These are different months in which you can perform Umrah.
Yes.
If you want to perform one Umrah in different months for yourself, you should do so, it's permissible. But if you want to perform two Umrahs in the same month, you can do it on behalf of different people. Now, if you want to perform five Umrahs, okay, one Umrah on your behalf for yourself, another on behalf of your father, another on behalf of your mother, and of course you cannot perform one Umrah on behalf of, let's say, a group of people, okay? One Umrah can be performed on behalf of one individual at a time. So you can perform different Umrahs, many Umrahs in the same month or in the same week, but on behalf of different people.
Uh-huh.
Now your father, your mother, and your siblings are there. You can perform Umrah on their behalf in the same month, and it's not, there's no problem in repeating the Umrah.
But they cannot do this with their own intention. Like, for example, they can't do it like for the sake of other people, only for themselves.
You cannot do it for yourself, I said. But you can
only.
But you can perform Umrahs and many and repeat it. And
as a proxy for others.
As a proxy for others. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I see.
For different people.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, you know, for your nice answers up until now in this part of the program. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back with more questions about Hajj in this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the jurisprudential rules of Hajj according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, Hajj Tamattu includes two acts.
Sure.
As you know better than me, the Umrah Tamattu and Hajj Tamattu, right?
Yes.
Umrah Tamattu is prior to Hajj Tamattu. Right?
Yes.
And both of these, in fact, acts have a specific deeds and rituals that, you know, need to be observed, of course, which are discussed in their respective places.
Sure.
But I want to ask you this question that, you know, what are the special deeds and acts or rituals that need to be done for Umrah Tamattu?
That's a good question. The first thing that we need to do for Umrah Tamattu is to wear ihram.
Mm-hmm.
And ihram is the hajj dress, special hajj dress from which you wear at a miqat or at a station.
Yes.
And ihram is obligatory for men only, you know. They need to change their dress. They cannot wear the regular stitched and woven clothes, you know.
Yes.
Men should wear two pieces of clothes, white, preferably white. You know, it's not necessary to wear white, actually.
Uh-huh.
It's good to wear white, but it should not be stitched, okay? It's stitched together with a needle or something like that.
So it needs to be two pieces.
Yeah, two
not
pieces.
One piece.
Not one piece, okay. Because there should be one piece, you will put it on your shoulder. It will cover your belly, your stomach, okay? And the other one will be wear as, you know, you call it izar, it's something like that. You will tie it around your waist.
Yes.
And to cover your legs. And so wearing ihram is the first thing that one should do. And of course, it's not only wearing ihram, but you should make niyyah, you should recite the talbiyah. And it should be wear the dress, the hajj clothing should be worn at a miqat, not anywhere out of miqat. Of course, there are people. Now, one thing I would like to bring to your notice and also to the notice of those people who listen to us,
mm-hmm,
is that many Shia Muslims who live in a predominantly Sunni populated country or society are under the impression of the Sunni culture and Sunni beliefs and thought system, okay?
Yes.
They tend to believe that they can wear ihram from the airport or while they are on board a plane,
mm-hmm,
okay? Or they can wear ihram from their houses. That's not the case.
Right.
It is absolutely forbidden to wear ihram from your home or from the airport or from anywhere else other than miqat. Miqat is the place appointed and fixed for wearing ihram,
yes,
okay? So we should consider that. And those Shia Muslims who still believe that miqat can be worn at any place, that's not true. Of course, if you want to wear miqat by way of nazr, okay? If you just say, okay, walillahi alayya an uhrim, for example, or this is from Allah upon me to wear ihram from Jeddah airport. Mm-hmm. If you make a nazr, of course, you can do it. You mm-hmm. can wear ihram from the airport by way of nazr. It's a kind of pledge, it's a kind of vow that you make it your obligatory upon yourself.
Right.
Okay. If there's no such thing, if there's no nazr, okay, you should go straight to the miqat and perform and wear the ihram from that station. Now, this is number one, okay, wearing ihram. The second obligatory deed is to perform tawaf around the Holy Kaaba. Mm-hmm. After you wear the ihram and you move on towards the Mecca, you will enter the city of Mecca. You will go straight to the house of Allah, and there you will perform the tawaf, which is called circumambulation of the house of God. You will move and walk around the house, the Kaaba, anti-clockwise.
Yes.
Seven times, beginning from the black stone, from Hajar al-Aswad, and finishing the seventh round at the same point. And of course, there are certain requirements, conditions which must be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. So we are just giving a cursory or an outline of what we are supposed to do there. And then after performing the tawaf, we should perform the prayer of tawaf. Prayer of tawaf is part of the tawaf.
Yes.
And they cannot be separated. After you complete the tawaf, you should move out of the crowded place and leave the space and go somewhere to perform the prayer. It's better to perform the tawaf within the Maqam Ibrahim and the Kaaba. If that's not possible, okay, you can move out and offer your prayer at a place where prayer is easy and possible. And then we have Sa'i. Of course, Sa'i means to walk between the mountains of Safa and Marwa. So
it's a kind of jogging.
It's a kind of jogging. You walk briskly.
Yes.
And again, you will have to walk back and forth, seven times.
Right.
And then the final thing that you should do is taqsir. Taqsir means to cut a small quantity of your hair or nail, okay? Mm-hmm. Whatever. You are not going to clean shave yourself or your head. It's better that you leave your hair for the Hajjatul Tamattu, because you will have to do the main Hajj.
Yes.
Hajjatul Islam.
Okay.
Yeah, on the 10th day of Zilhajjah, you will have to perform the halq.
Yes.
Halq means shaving.
Mm-hmm, I see.
So these are the five obligatory deeds or acts of Umrah at-Tamattu, which must be performed and which must be learned properly and done properly.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed, for your nice answers to these questions around Hajj, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, my dear audience, for listening to this program. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.